I'm Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview. On today's show, I'll welcome Sidney Finkelstein, author of Why Smart Executives Fail and director of the Tuck School of Business's Center for Leadership at Dartmouth College. His latest book is Super Bosses: How Exceptional Leaders Master the Flow of Talent. Stick around, and don't let the glow of business talk scare you off. We're going to talk about Miles Davis, Lorne Michaels, George Lucas, NFL coach Bill Walsh, Ralph Lauren, and even B-movie king Roger Corman. I just know there will be people watching or hearing this podcast who will hear that my guest's new book is called Super Bosses, and they'll have a common response. Super schmucks. Okay, get it out of your system now, because Sidney Finkelstein's new book, Super Bosses: How Exceptional Leaders Master the Flow of Talent, will make you rethink your entire approach to work, whether you're a worker or a boss or somewhere in between. The whole idea of Super Bosses is that there's a generation of remarkable business leaders across industry, sports, and the arts even, who appreciate and nurture talent. They will kick your ass from here to next week, likely pay you less, and expect you to work longer hours than seems natural. But they could potentially change the rest of your life for the better. Now, I believe this extremely well-written book and its author will appeal to the rather broad Mr. Media audience, because of whom Finkelstein anoints as super bosses. That includes Miles Davis, Alice Waters, Lorne Michaels, Ralph Lauren, Norman Brinker, Bill Walsh, Julian Robertson, Larry Ellison, Roger Corman, and George Lucas. When we're done talking, you'll want to ask yourself some serious questions, starting with, where can I find a super boss of my own? As for Sidney Finkelstein, he spent more than a decade working on the concepts, theories, and observations that form the spine of super bosses. He did so from a great vantage point, too. He is the Stephen Roth Professor of Management at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, as well as Tuck's Director of the Center for Leadership. Super Bosses, by the way, is his ninth book, a catalog that includes the bestseller Why Smart Executives Fail. And with that, Sidney Finkelstein, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you, Bob. Good to be on with you.
Good to have you. So tell someone who has never had a decent boss, let alone a super boss, what they're missing.
Well, you know, a super boss is someone that helps other people actually accomplish more than they ever thought possible. And that is a tall order, but that is what they do. They push you, they challenge you, and they create opportunities for you to get better. And the net effect is not only that you help them, your boss, be successful, but it allows you potentially to turbocharge your own career and start to write your own ticket in opportunities that emerge after that.
Now, are super bosses born or are they made?
I think there's no question that some people are better than others from the get-go on just about anything, whether it is around leadership or creativity or even athletics. But the truth is that every single person could become a super boss. This is a big deal, really, and one of the things I discovered as I went along and asked the same type of question. It turns out that every aspect of what I call the super boss playbook is teachable, it's learnable, it's all out there. It's there for the getting.
Did you find that the people who were super bosses – did they intend to be super bosses? What I mean is, are they just being who they are, or did they actually set out a plan and say, I'm going to be a great boss, I'm going to inspire men and women, I'm going to look for the right traits, or is it just, does it just come more naturally to some people?
Yeah, so there's definitely a little bit of variety there. I think there are very few that started out in life and said, this is what I'm going to do. But as you get into it and do whatever it is you're doing, a Norman Brinker who started the Chili's restaurant chain, and his proteges have become the CEOs and senior executives at, you know, P.F. Chang and Lone Star and all kinds of restaurants like that. He really valued this idea of helping other people get better, of nurturing other people. So he was someone that came to it pretty early in their careers. Others, I would say, just kind of happened as a kind of organic, natural process. Some of the real creative types, you mentioned Miles Davis. Well, Miles Davis certainly didn't sit around, you know, his advisors thinking about how to be a good boss. It just kind of happened, and it happened in a very natural, organic way. So there's some variety there.
Well, all right, you mentioned Miles. I was going to bring him up a little later, but let's go to Miles now. He's no longer with us, but he was a musician of the highest repute. However, not regarded as well as a human being by many people. You point out correctly that he would often, and most often, turn his back on audiences. He really didn't care what their response was. How on earth do you wind up with a guy like Miles Davis in a book like this?
Yeah, it's one of the most fascinating of all the examples that we discovered. And the thing that's special about Miles Davis, and remember, what is it? What is a super boss? A super boss is a person who helps other people do more than they ever thought possible. Well, look at the bands that he created over time, and look at the people, the talent that he discovered, that he helped get better. I mean, we're talking about, you know, superstars of jazz, Herbie Hancock and Bill Evans and Wayne Shorter and John Coltrane, and the list goes on and on and on. That's the definition of what a super boss does. The fact that somebody like Miles Davis could be like that, even though he has, as you say, other parts of his life that maybe are not quite as impressive, goes to show you that anyone could become a super boss. It's all about helping other people get better directly or indirectly, and Miles did that.
How did you – I mean, there's a lot of pretty good bosses out there. Mm-hmm. How did you draw the line? Did you set a number? Did you make a flow chart of these are all the characteristics, and if you don't have all of these, you don't make it? I mean, how do you
right,
you
sure.
spend all these years on this? A lot of people probably came and went as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about that. But the way I did it is a very straightforward method. I looked at all of the major companies or organizations, or in the case of jazz, great musicians that are major players in an industry or in a sector. And then I did a genealogical study, if you will, of them, which is to say I looked at who they work for. And you kind of create this tree of talent, which is a term that's been used for the National Football League and Bill Walsh and a couple of others. And you do this study, and when you do that and you map out where everybody came from, where the key people in an industry came from, you know what you discover is that one person had this gigantic effect on the development of a generation, or sometimes generations, of talent. And those are the people that I ended up calling super bosses. And then once I knew who those people were, the question really became, well, what do they do and how do they do it, and how could I learn how to do that as well?
You chart former NFL coach Bill Walsh at the beginning, and that was amazing to me to see all the guys who would come up under him. And, you know, the number of coaches under him who had been to the Super Bowl had, you know, that was absolutely amazing, because, I mean, football is not necessarily always the most nurturing of environments.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It is amazing, because even today, out of the top, there's 32 head coaches in the NFL. 20 of them came from the Bill Walsh tree of talent. That doesn't mean they directly worked for him, although many did, but they may have worked for someone who worked directly for Bill Walsh. And by the way, in the Super Bowl this year, 2016 Super Bowl, the two head coaches are both from the same tree of talent. So there's something pretty amazing that's going on. Bill Walsh has been gone for maybe a decade. He hasn't coached for a couple of decades. You don't want to talk about legacy. This is an incredible example of that.
You know, it didn't occur to me until just now. Tony Dungy, who just about a week ago got into the Hall of Fame, has actually spawned a number of coaches that have done very well. Maybe I don't know how many have become head coaches, but they have really spread his philosophy and his approach pretty wide.
Yeah, I think that's right. There are there are others as well. Remember, there's Bill Parcells. A lot of people give him a lot of credit for spawning talent, and he has. Although when you have Belichick as your primary person, and he keeps getting in the Super Bowl or winning by hook or by crook. He is – I shouldn't have said that. I live in New England, but okay.
He may not be helping the franchise. He may not be helping the brand, I should say.
They're doing all right, actually. I don't think Bob Kraft's upset.
It's the hooker by crook part.
Yes. So in any event, in the NFL, there are examples of this. But what I was interested in is looking at all the head coaches. Bill Walsh is far and away number one.
Hmm. So how important is a super boss to the career of the average working stiff? Or is it more of an issue for managers and senior executives?
Well, I think there are super bosses up and down an organization. As I've written the book and talked to a lot of people about this, many people tell me about a super boss that they had themselves. And so I think it's actually relevant for anyone, and for a couple of reasons. Number one, anyone could become a super boss, but maybe more to your point, we've all had bosses, and we've had a mix of those bosses, maybe some good ones, maybe an exceptional super boss-like boss if we were lucky, but probably a few not-so-great ones. And why does that have to be that way? I know it happens. I know it's common. But why do we have to have organizations where people we spend 8 or 10 hours a day with are people that we don't want to be with, we don't want to hang out with, and we don't even respect what they do? I know we're not going to get rid of that just overnight. It's too big of a problem to crack. But we can make some progress on that. And if more managers at any level, supervisors at any level, want to take on more of what the super bosses do in terms of developing people and pushing people and challenging them and giving them those opportunities, there'll be a lot of people that are going to like that and going to have a better experience at work. And remember this, employee engagement numbers are disastrous, right? You've seen all those polls, Gallup poll, and I mean, it's like a quarter of workers that are surveyed in these employee engagement surveys actually say that they're highly engaged on the job. I mean, that's an unbelievable thing. Why does it have to be that way? And I'm not going to say super boss is going to solve everyone's problem, but it's going to help.
Well, one of the things I think you point out in the book is that the super boss is having a super boss doesn't necessarily mean you're going to stay with that boss or that company for life. As a matter of fact, it seems more likely you're going to be there for a while, take what you've learned, and then go off and live probably a happier existence somewhere else.
Well, they're in the business of creating opportunities. And some of those opportunities are on the job, but some of those opportunities are also giving you the skill set and the confidence to believe that you can take on something bigger and better. And yes, a lot of proteges of super bosses leave and they take on big jobs all over the place. It's the hallmark of a super boss.
I know I make my living generally writing, co-authoring books with CEOs, and generally what I hear a lot is that they're always encouraging their people to hire people as smart or smarter than themselves to work for them. And they realize that means they probably won't stay with them quite as long, but that, you know, it's the only way to grow. If you're afraid of the people working under you, that they're going to supersede you, you're not going to grow as far. Correct?
Yeah, that's encouraging to hear that some of those CEOs you're working with say that. I haven't always heard that, even though, again, it's not rocket science. The idea of having better people around you is going to help you get better. So why wouldn't you want the smartest, the best, the most talented? That's all that super bosses care about. But I think that what it points out, that it's not maybe as widespread as it could be, is a question of self-confidence and maybe some insecurity. You know, CEOs are people. Every manager is a person. And they don't always want to be surrounded by people that could, in theory, maybe show them up. And so I find that super bosses, this is kind of interesting, super bosses are very, very self-confident. They do not lack for ego. But, and I call this in the book, the big personality paradox. They have these big, larger-than-life personalities sometimes. They are strong players. As I said, very self-confident. But they are able to leave room for other people to have an impact. They're able to step aside on occasion to leave room for other people. And those other people then have this incredible chance to get better at doing whatever they do. And you mentioned, you know, at the beginning, Why Smart Executives Fail is the first book that was really kind of well known that I wrote. And some of those CEOs and senior executives in Why Smart Executives Fail, they also had really big egos. They really did believe they were masters of the universe. But the difference was that those people, the Why Smart Executives Fail leaders, they didn't think they needed anybody to help them. They thought they were smarter than everybody else. The super bosses understand that no matter how good they are, no matter how much they've accomplished, the only way to win is to have the best people around you and to keep raising the bar. And it's exactly right, and I think it's the big differentiator that they bring to the table.
You talk about in financial services,
Robertson.
Julian Robertson, thank you, Tiger, who not only is one of your super bosses, but in several cases, people that he has brought along have then gone off and started their own hedge funds, and he's invested with them. I mean, that to me sounds like the surest sign that he really believed in these guys, that he put his mouth where his management skills were, apparently.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing, because sometimes when you think about some of these great talents, they'll end up leaving, they'll want bigger jobs, and you say, well, why do I want to do that? Why do I want to lose some of that great talent? Well, it's not that you want to lose them, but let's face it, you can't hold on to them if they don't want to stay. They have the ability to go wherever they want to go. And so once you realize that, the only question then is, can I be strategic about this? Can I leverage this? And Julian Robertson is one of the best examples of that. He trains people, he helps them get better, and then he actually launches them into their career. He'll give them, you know, in case of some of these Tiger Cubs, as they've been called, $25 million to start investing. I mean, they don't give them the money, but that's the pool of investment
right.
that they've got. And that's a big bet to make on somebody. And he takes an equity stake in that business. So he believes in them. He's helped them get better. He's taught them. And then they go off on their own, and he leverages that. It's a very smart thing to do. And by the way, there's a lot of other super bosses that do it in their own way. You think about, take a completely different example, Lorne Michaels from Saturday Night Live. Well, who's on late night TV? You got Jimmy Fallon. You got Seth Meyers. They're both from SNL, both alums from SNL. And who's the executive producer of those shows? Turns out it's Lorne Michaels. So there are ways to leverage and be strategic and capitalize on the talent you're developing even after they leave your own organization, your own team.
Conan O'Brien also came up through SNL.
Another good – well, Tina Fey and 30 Fey, yeah. Rock and Amy Poehler. It's a long list.
Right. But in terms of like just late night hosts, I'm thinking, you know, Conan, of course, he was a writer at the time, but still.
Yes.
All right, so for someone who is watching this show or listening to the podcast, should they think about should they be thinking, you know, I'm going to quit my job and go out and find a super boss, or you know, should they at the very least maybe look at the traits that are outlined in the book in terms of choosing their next position and saying, I'm not going to settle for just a job. I want someone who's going to, you know, help me the way these super bosses have helped these other people.
You're saying, should they look for somebody like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the answer is yes. It's easier said than done, but the answer is yes. You do want to find people like that because, well, it's not for everyone. I don't want to say it's for everyone. I'm making it sound like it's, you know, it's the greatest thing ever. It is if you are ambitious, if you want to get better, if you want a bigger job, but not everybody wants to put in that type of effort. So let's put that to the side and recognize it's not it's not for 100% of the people out there, but it is for people that want to that want to create opportunities for themselves. And then the question is, how do you find them? And I think there's a lot of things you can do, including how you interview, if you will, the person interviewing you. You know, when you're interviewing for a job, second round, third round, what have you, and you're actually talking to your boss, not the HR person, there are a lot of things that you want to ask that person to get a sense. Are they more super boss-like or less so? For example, how about asking them, tell me about some of the people that used to work for you. Where are they today? What was that like? And you want to get an answer that says, yes, there's, you know, Tom, Dick, Mary, Hallie, and all these people that have moved on to do all these different things. How do you interact with, what does a typical day look like? For super bosses, they don't lock themselves up into meetings all day long. We all got meetings. We're not going to make that disappear. But all day long, no, they leave time for more unstructured interaction, for just kind of dropping by unannounced, for working closely together. And so what does that typical day look like? And if you say, oh, my God, I'm structured like crazy. You can't get through. You have two assistants to get through. There are all these little signals that you can pick up from the interview process. You also could do something if you're in a bigger company that has job boards, you know, digital job boards where they'll list, which is probably everybody does that in a bigger company, where they'll list job openings for different departments or different offices. Pay a little bit of attention to that and watch the pattern over time. And if you do, you may very well notice, well, there's one team or one office, let's say, where it never seems to be an opening. As soon as there's an opening in that office, it gets filled right away. And then there's another one where they always seem to need somebody. Now, why is that? And I would guess that very often for that team or that office, that whenever there's a job that's open, it gets filled right away. That's a leader in that team or a boss in that team that has developed a bit of a reputation for the place you want to go if you want to accelerate your career. I call those people talent magnets. They attract talent. And, you know, someone who's got the revolving door and never could hold on to anyone, well, there's a reason for that too. So those are things that you can track just internally, even before you're looking for the next move within your own organization. Pay a little bit of attention to that, and you get to see who are the people that are more likely to be the talent magnet, super boss type people, and who are the people that are going to be more like the let's churn them through, get everything we can out of them, and then who cares what happens next.
Now, even a super boss has to have a downside, maybe even a super downside. What are the downsides of working for super bosses?
Maybe the biggest is that this is a gigantic commitment, and it's not for everyone. They will push you, and they will push you hard. They have high expectations. If you can't meet those expectations, it's not going to work. It's not going to work out. You have to be willing to do certain things, such as you can't be afraid to push back and challenge. So, which is, you know, not obvious that you can do that, because some of these people could be intimidating. They're so successful, and you say, "Wow, one person after another has been developed from this super boss," and you want me to go and tell my boss, you know, "I think you're wrong about this. How could I ever say that?" Well, that's what the super bosses, want. They want that interaction. So the downside is that they make it challenging. It is not a walk in the park for any type of protege or team member, staff member. You got to be all in for a thing like this. And if you're not, you'll quickly be dropped, and it won't look too great. So you have to be, you got to really want a thing like this. If you do, the upside is huge, I think.
You also indicate that the downside for the employee who thrives in the system for a while may be that they reach a point where they have to leave for their own good, for the hours. I was one person before I was married and before I had a kid, but you know, then I was looking for a somewhat different situation and someone who was going to expect me to work till 3 a.m. Or in the case of even Lorne Michaels, who probably does not employ a lot of parents, you know, their day starts in the evening and goes all night. So, you know, you have to be able at some point to recognize that it's not as good for you as it used to be, and it may be time to move on. But take what you've learned.
I think that's right. The time commitment is significant. Super bosses work hard. And so, you know, maybe the way you just phrase it is exactly right. You know, spend the 2, 3, 5, 8, 10 years, whatever it happens to be, get everything you can, learn like crazy, and you're just going to be in a position to move that career forward where you get to call more of the shots. And maybe that's what you should be shooting for and trying to do.
So tell us a little bit about what inspired this. Did you, first of all, did you start with the title Super Bosses, or did that evolve over time?
So this is a really good question. I did not start with that title. In fact, for literally several years, my title was Godfathers of Talent. That didn't last, and there's a lot of obvious reasons why it doesn't last. But you know, when you read about some of these people, that's the term you sometimes hear, right? Godfathers and godmothers of the industry. And so it's a word that people use when they describe these personalities that have helped develop a lot of people in the industry. But you know, first of all, Godfathers is not gender neutral. It's got gigantic baggage that go with it. The funny thing is that in the introduction and in the draft of the introduction and chapter one, I had used the word superboss or superbosses a few places, and it never hit me that was really what I was talking about. And I got fixated on something that I don't think was nearly as effective. And what inspired me? So I'm a big foodie. I really I love to cook and I love to eat. And I noticed a few years ago, one of the restaurants that I really respect and admire, which is Chef Panisse in Berkeley. Alice Waters, the chef, is the restaurateur. She was the chef on occasion. It's the place that essentially reinvented farm-to-table organic food, local sourcing for high-end restaurants. And literally hundreds of people have gone through that restaurant. I don't mean just customers, which would be in the tens of thousands, if not more, but chefs or other people in the restaurant business got inspired by that and ended up creating their own businesses. And so I noticed that in the restaurant, high-end restaurant business, there was a pattern that was this kind of genealogical study pattern that I described earlier of a tree of talent. And I just thought that was kind of cool. And I wanted to know, is that true anywhere else? And then I went to the NFL for Bill Walsh, where there's really a strong case that could be made. And then I went to Julian Robertson, or actually I went to hedge funds to try to figure out, is there somebody there? Advertising, music, consumer packaged goods, comedy, fashion. And every industry I looked at, I found somebody. So I kind of started as more of a hobby than anything else, and just found it interesting, and just wanted to see, you know, how deep is this pattern? How common is this pattern of this one or two giants within an industry that develop a generation of talent.
And tell us a little about your own experience with bosses, more super bosses or super schmucks?
Well, you know, I'm a professor, so I'm an academic. And one thing we have to say, for better or for worse, about academics is you tend not to have very many bosses. And that's because of the beauty of tenure. But that wasn't always that way. And so as a graduate student, I did have a boss that was very much like a super boss. And I worked crazy hours, really hard, learned a lot, got huge opportunities. We're very close to this day, and that's, you know, three decades now. And so I have had a little bit of experience in my own life, my own career, about working with a super boss. But I haven't had a ton of bosses myself. I've tried to be a good boss because, you know, I have my own kind of little business in consulting, and I work with so many students, and I'm a teacher. And so quite a bit of the super boss playbook is relevant for people doing those types of things.
All right. So, you know, there are 18 people who are identified in the book as super bosses specifically. So I wanted to just ask you about a couple more that we haven't already touched on. Ralph Lauren, the fashion giant, how did he make it to your attention, basically?
You know, by acclamation. Everyone in that industry says the same person when you start talking to them. It's just incredible. Dozens and dozens of people from, you know, Tory Burch and Vera Wang, Joseph Aboud, so many people. And this is interesting. On the design side, the creative side, and on the business side, the CEO of Michael Kors, John Idol, worked for him. So it was an easy one. And we looked at other people as well just to see, are we finding the right guy? And it became overwhelmingly the case.
A surprise for me on your list was George Lucas. I would have thought Steven Spielberg or his partner at DreamWorks, Jeff Katzenberg, perhaps. Yeah. But Lucas, I don't know. I'm still kind of fuzzy on that one. Why, yeah. Lucas over of all the people, you know, in major film leaders? Why Lucas?
So George Lucas, in particular, I picked him less so for film, although you can't separate him from. As a filmmaker, like a Steven Spielberg, but for digital technologies, and he created Industrial Light and Magic (ILM). He created Pixar. Turns out that it's got to be 15, 20 different companies were created out of his workshop out in Skywalker Ranch. And what happened is he had a vision for a film he wanted to make that eventually became Star Wars. But the vision he had could not be fulfilled with the technology of the day, and so he realized. And he had a little bit of money from American Graffiti at that time, which was a big hit. He realized, I need to create all this stuff. And so he started hiring PhDs, you know, in physics and all kinds of other young people, and created this this kind of film academy out there in Marin County in California. And you look at so many of the people that he worked with who become big names in the technology side of the technology side of the business. So less so for film, even though again you can't separate it, but certainly on the digital technology side.
Okay, that makes sense. The like Pixar, I mean, he walked away from essentially.
He did.
He didn't make it what it was, and that makes sense. On the film side, well, we'll get to that in a second. Let's continue on that path then. Actually, Roger Corman, clearly on the film side, has inspired and created an army of people. And you know, people are always surprised at, you know, when they hear Roger Corman getting credit for anything. But the reality is, both as directors, producers, actors, artists, I mean, probably as much or more so than anybody.
Yeah, when it comes to film, there's only one person, and that's Roger Corman. And, you know, he's the king of the B-movies, and he made – you know, all these really cheap movies for $1 million or less sometimes, and they were known as sexploitation films and everything like that. And he wasn't going after any Academy Awards, although I think he was honored for one over the course of his career. And so he had this incredible eye for talent. He hired, you know, Jack Nicholson. He hired everybody when they were nobody. Robert De Niro, Ron Howard came to him, and Ron Howard had been in a couple of TV shows, of course, you know, Opie and others. But when he wanted to learn how to make film, nobody was going to tell him, here's you know, $25 million and direct a film. But Roger Corman said, yeah, I will. not 25 million, but $1 million. And you know, a lot of other directors, James Cameron, Francis Ford Coppola, and a lot of these directors, they worked for Roger Corman on the cheap, which is part of what Roger Corman did. He made these types of cheap movies. He gave them huge responsibility, and he constantly taught them one thing after another about, you know, the technology of film. So it's a real standout. And there have been a couple of reunions where I must be in the hundreds of people that show up to go to these reunions to honor Roger Corman.
I think Coppola was the only one who didn't learn the financial lessons of making a movie from him. Everyone else seems to have gotten it, and Francis Ford, he's still made some brilliant films, but he struggled on the financial side of making his movies. Larry Ellison is on the list. Larry Ellison, pretty notorious ball buster, maybe the premier ball buster on the Super Boss list. I remember reading a friend of mine, Mike. Oh my God, my mind just went blank. He wrote the book, The Difference. I love the title, The Difference Between God and Larry Ellison. Mm-hmm. God doesn't think he's Larry Ellison. Mm-hmm. Now, how does a guy like Ellison get on the list? He's got a lot of drawbacks as a boss.
Right. So you have to remember what is a super boss? A super boss is a person, a boss, that creates gigantic opportunities, helps other people get much better, and allows them to accelerate their career. Nowhere in that definition of a super boss is nice guy, nurturer, though some of them are. And you know, Larry Ellison's definitely a tough guy. And, he's in this category I call glorious bastards. They are they're not friendly, they're not easy to deal with, but if you can handle it, if you could manage it, the learning is great. You know, Mark Benioff is the CEO of Salesforce.com, gigantic success in his own right, and Craig Conway and many others. And they had to struggle through something to get there. But I think it's important to note that working for a super boss is not just, you know, getting this touchy-feely, friendly person. Occasionally you get somebody like that. Norman Brinker certainly was a big nurturer, but others are not that way. And again, it's not for everybody. Larry Ellison is, I don't know whether I'd say it's an acquired taste, but it's a challenging taste.
All right, so one more thing I want to ask you about. We talked about Alice Waters, the restaurateur and chef, the only woman on the list. I mean, even before I read the book, it stood out from looking at the materials that she's the only woman on the list. And what I was thinking was that if Miles Davis could make this list of super bosses, I did a little checking. I mean, why no Sheryl Sandberg or Mary Barra, Kathleen Kennedy, Marissa Meyer, or the CEO at Pepsi, whose name I cannot pronounce, Indra Nooyi, I think, perhaps. Even Taylor Swift runs a business and has an excellent reputation for making the people who work for her very successful and, you know, going off. Are women somehow not as nurturing in the corporate suite as men?
Well, I would never say that. And I recognize, as the research was going along, exactly the same challenge. And I said, okay, that can't be right. I got to figure this out. And so we spent a lot of time, and it turns out, and maybe it's partly a function of the role of women as senior executives at this stage of development. And I think 10 years down the line, there's going to be a big difference. But I do mention Sheryl Sandberg as an emerging super boss, but it's still a little bit early. I mentioned Ann Richards, who was the governor of Texas, and there's a lot of people that came out of her team that have become successful. Even Hillary Clinton, one of the more controversial super bosses that's in the book, mostly for the network that was created. Bonnie Fuller, who in the publishing and the magazine business, very, very big name. So there are some, but not nearly enough, in my opinion. And I don't want anyone to think, you know, I purposely decided that's the way it is, but there's something that about women that doesn't allow them to be super bosses. I don't think that any of that is the case. I think we're at a stage where it's still early, given, you know, just look at the Fortune 500, if you want to take that. How many are women? CEOs are women. It's something like 20 or 22 or 23 out of 500. It's tiny numbers. And that's what the problem is bigger. That's the biggest problem more than anything else.
So you think a generation from now, if we come back and have the same conversation, You know, we'll have people, we'll be on feeding tubes and that kind of thing. But if we have the same conversation in a generation, we'll be able to see more more evidence of what this today's generation of women leaders have left in their wake. Then we'll know if they were nurturing or not.
I think there's no question, even 10 years from now, that if I were to go back and do a kind of quick second study to try to figure out who's out there, I would have a much bigger, greater representation of women. I think there's no question about it.
Okay. So Superboss is a great title. It's a great read. What's next? Have you started on something new?
Oh, my God. After all these years on this one, I'm still playing around with it and writing a lot about this and trying to think about it in a more global dimension. I only looked at America, North America, and Europe for the most part, and I want to look at China and India and other regions of the world. Who are the super bosses there? How do they differ from the ones that are in the book? And I have other projects as well that are in the early days, but nothing that I'm about to start tomorrow, given how much time I spent on this one.
Got it. Well, it does seem like super bosses could be a very enduring concept and carry a lot of spinoff to it. Well, folks, listen, you can find Sidney Finkelstein's latest book, Super Bosses, How Exceptional Leaders Master the Flow of Talent, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching the show on MrMedia.com, you can look below the video and either on the left or most likely on the right. You'll see the cover of the book. You can click on it right now. It'll take you to Amazon. I understand that they can get it copied to you in 30 minutes or less. You know, they might as well order a pizza and a book. And if they can't get it to you know, that quickly, you can get the ebook, or they'll get it to you tomorrow. So go ahead and order it there. Is there a do you have a website? Are you a social media guy at all?
Yes, I am. And so superbosses.com is where I've been posting a variety of things about the book, including a lot of the press that's come out and some commentary from different people. And I'm on Twitter at Sid Finkelstein, which is S-Y-D. Finkelstein, Sid Finkelstein on Twitter.
Very good. Well, Sidney, it was a pleasure reading the book. Really interesting. And thank you so much for joining us today on Mr. Media.
Thank you, Bob. It's been a lot of fun.
Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of corporate drones who didn't realize how much fun working for a living could be until 25 minutes from now, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.